are in bear country.
Okay, hello everybody. Today we have an awesome guest. This is Hap Wilson. He's an author of 15 books. He is a canoe tripping woodsman, outdoor savant in general, owner of Cabin Falls Eco Lodge, owner of Eco Trail Builders, excellent presenter at all kinds of outdoor events, and a longtime icon of conservation in the outdoors. Hap, welcome. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jim. Real pleasure to sit here and chat with you. Thanks.
You're very, very welcome. So I'm going to go back a few years and to a story of actually the first time that I met you in the flesh. I don't think it could be a more cool way to meet Hap Wilson, but you're sitting in your cabin on the Lady Evelyn River. It's late in the evening and it's a nice night out, and you hear some sort of sound. Or what exactly happened?
Well, it's actually a long story, because we had paddled out with the kids, and the kids were fairly young at the time, and Andrea and I were on our way back to Tomogamy. We were paddling out and we got totally drenched, and we were camped near Frank Falls, and we decided, well, let's go back to the cabin. We'll dry out and we'll go the next day. So we actually hiked back, because we have a trail from center, and we got back to the cabin and dried out and just relaxing, and all of a sudden we heard a lot of shouting and banging and noise across the river. That's where the portage is. Uh-huh. So I thought, wow, these guys, they must be troublemakers, you know? So I went to the, and it was pitch black. There was, you know, I went over, paddling over, I grabbed one of our old canoes, and it had a kind of a shaky seat. And I remember kind of sneaking over, and the seat actually broke, mm-hmm. just below the portage, below the campsite, and it made a bang. Mm-hmm. And then that caused a flurry of excitement, I think, up at the campsite, because I heard a lot more shouting and screaming. And I thought, well, I'm gonna continue this. So I got out of the canoe, pulled up quietly, and I snuck up through the bush on my belly about a good 100 meters up the slope, over logs, under round rocks. I got within, must be 20 feet of the fire. And I saw the there were two strange things. Mm-hmm. One was the dog laying there, mm-hmm. who didn't sniff me out. It didn't mm-hmm. know I was there.
Who was supposed to be a herding dog as well.
I know. And but I'm pretty good. I had a lot of practice doing this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. When I was younger. Anyway, I took a while looking at this guy, pretty big guy standing beside the fire, sharpening this stick. Mm-hmm. to a very sharp point, and I'm thinking, man, if I jump out on these guys and scare the bejeebers out of them, I'm going to have that thing stuck through my heart. So I contemplated, what am I going to do? You know, so I think I made it. I didn't really jump out to try this guy. I just kind of nonchalantly walked into the campfire.
I think you made a bear noise, actually.
Yeah, I could have done. I could have done that. That's probably true. So, but no, we sat there and we shared a drink and a couple of stories, and that's when I first met the famous. Your brother was there, or no?
Brother Ted, my cousin Brad, and our buddy Will.
Yep, the Baird family, the trio, and the dog, and then I guess the rest is history.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah. I don't think I was had really done a whole lot in the way of. I guess I had started doing some producing some outdoor content and getting some stuff out there at that time, but I hadn't. I hadn't really been around in the same kind of way as I guess I am now with all I've done up until this point.
But yeah, I think at that time, I think you had this kind of resident fear of bears. So I think you had a couple of incidents upriver.
Yeah.
And especially when my seat collapsed and made a bang, I think you were you know, you were thinking, it's got to be a bear down below the portage. So you're busy sharpening that spear.
Yeah, basically before we went off, the backstory is we were being warned a lot about bears. It's a bad, the berry crop has failed this year. It's been a bad bear year, you know, watch out for bears. So, you know, Francis told us that to Francis, the guy that gave us our shuttle from the smooth water, and at least one other person to two other people had warned us that, you know, the berry crop had failed. We also were maybe just being kind of wusses, but we also saw a big black bear just before that, not too far upriver, that didn't seem as scared of us as we would have liked it to have been. And also it was a really low water year too. So I remember that we didn't have that comfort of deep water between us and a bear that didn't seem scared enough. And then when we got to camp, we're cooking speckled trout and steak over the fire. And we're by a waterfall, which from my experience, usually seems to throw off animals like bears. And even one time I had a wolf they can't make out the sounds of the human, you know, maybe the, or like, I don't know what else, I don't know if it affects the scent. So right before you came over, we actually had a bear come up to our campsite. Now this is debatable, but this is what a bear sounds like in the woods. Well, we're just like, and then you never hear anything else.
Yeah, so do mice at night too.
So we were screaming, red squirrels. So we were yelling because when you heard us having a big, like, screaming and yelling over there, that was us trying to make noise to get this bear on its way. And then when we heard what was your seat break, we thought the bear wasn't scared of us, and that was the bear coming back. So I just wanted to take a second to talk about a sponsor for this podcast episode. This is Gentle Bands, and Gentle Bands makes rugged, outdoorsy feeling wedding bands. If you remember a few years back when I was doing a trip on the North French River and battling crazy thickets, and I actually lost my wedding band in the river because it got pulled off by a stick.
Oh, I lost my wedding ring. Damn it.
So it's a really cool brand, really kind of reimagining the way that men's wedding bands go, for sure. Certificate of craftsmanship. Yeah, that's cool. Now let's take a look at this ring. That is pretty cool. This ring is called the White Forest. It's made out of tungsten and wood. You can see the wood grains on the inside, which is really cool. So tungsten is just about being dense and sturdy. I just love the trees. It kind of speaks to me because it reminds me of some of the northern black spruce country that I travel through on some of my expeditions. So if you want to check it out yourself, their package is super cool and they offer free engraving services at the moment. There is actually a 25% off discount code. You can head over to gentlebands.com. There'll be a link in my bio and use Jim Baird, one word. I'll wear one of these any day because this is, I feel like, made just for me. Pretty cool. How did you know, you're talking about learning about how to creep up like that on people and not spook their dog. Where did you learn that from?
Well, stealth has always been important for still hunting for our indigenous populations, and it still is. And I was lucky as a young kid, north of Peterborough, we had a cottage there, and there was a lot of crown land in behind. And my father was making survival movies for the Department of Lands and Forests back then. And he had one elder woodsman on the set. He was being filmed for all of that bushcraft, that great stuff that is just coming into practice over the last few years. And you know, he took my brother and I out in the bush between filming and making campfires, how to build a fire, how to boil water in a birch bark bowl. A lot of it was orienteering. A lot of it was stealth walking and walking on a trail when there wasn't a trail you know, and looking at signs, always looking at signs and always looking behind you where you've been, so you know how to go back to where you started. So part, you know, a lot of that was stealth, and that's something that I was taught at a very early age, and I just practiced that. And I thought that this is great. I can sneak up on just about anything. And the same with canoeing, stealth canoeing. I've had the opportunity to, you know, paddle within meters of moose and other game animals, other bird species, just by practicing what I learned as a young kid from this native person. And that inspired me. That inspired me so much that, and it wasn't a lot of language between us. It was mostly impressions, facial, expressions, and gestures. And it was all to me as a young kid. It was all magic. I want to be like him when I get older. And the odd thing is when I got a call from my indigenous friend Alex Mathias, and I think you know Alex. You mm-hmm. did some filming with Alex. Mm-hmm. Well, before I really got to know him, he called me up and he said, "Hap, we've got to talk." He says, and I went down and I met him. He said, "Well, he had told me previously that he'd had several dreams about me." Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, this is interesting mm-hmm. when an indigenous, mm-hmm. you know, calls a white guy and says he's been dreaming about him. And, mm-hmm. I took this seriously. And he said, "Look, Hap, it's unfortunate you were born a white guy this time around. But, mm-hmm. you know, in a past life, you were my warrior brother. Mm-hmm. And your name is Mahingan Weebada, which means mm-hmm. wolf tooth." And I thought, man, that's, you know, almost in some ways it makes this kind of mystical sense that when I was a young kid, you know, mm-hmm. learning all these skills, you know, from an Anishinaabe elder, and then, you know, decades later being told that I was born a native person mm-hmm. In a previous life. That was mm-hmm. pretty important. It was pretty mm-hmm. Eye-opening to me. And since in between that time, I had spent a lot of time even studying the Ojibwe language. Mm-hmm. And learning skills, axe throwing, knife throwing, mm-hmm. all of those campcraft things that are just, you know, becoming popular now. Mm-hmm. I learned those when I was a preteen, you mm-hmm. know, and running pretty wild, you know, in a homemade loincloth, you know, carving my own bow mm-hmm. and, you know, and shooting wild game. And mm-hmm. Probably because I had dysfunctional parents, that mm-hmm. sent me out in the bush a lot more than...
And how old were you at this time when you were making these first bows and when you were just...
Really- Probably around... we moved north from Toronto, Willowdale. And funny yeah. thing is, I was almost shot when I was 10 months old in Willowdale. Wow. Some young 16-year-old was shooting crows mm-hmm. three blocks away in Willowdale when you could do that kind of thing. Mm. The bullet just missed my tram out on the back porch and went through the kitchen door and just missed my parents. Mm-hmm. two or three years ago, we had a client, a mm-hmm. guest up at our cabin who read the story. That story and the person's name was in because I had that old newspaper clipping from the Telegram from the Toronto Star printed that in the papers about young David Wilson almost being shot in his pram out the back door in Willowdale. And they named this fellow. And this woman who was a guest at our cabin says, "Well, I read the book, The Cabin, that was in the cabin." Mm-hmm. And plus the fellow's name. "Well, that guy you mentioned in the book was my uncle," she said. "No He's kidding. Like 86 years old now." Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, I got to track him down because he almost killed me when I was 10 months old." Wow. But anyway, I was fortunate because I was learning a lot of skills. I had already learned a lot of skills. I had, you know, dabbled in canoeing. I had this great fear of water. When I was young. And you wouldn't know it, I mean, today.
Definitely not.
Although
Maybe that's why you're such a good at not dumping, though.
It could be. It could be. And I hate getting my feet wet. I'll do anything to get my feet wet. I love lining canoes. Mm-hmm. And, I see traditionally you would jump out of your canoe before you get to shore, because we used to travel with cedar canvas canoes all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And you took care of that because you didn't want to have to do a field repair. So you jump out of your canoe, you get your feet wet. It didn't matter because your boots were always continuously wet anyway. You always had wet feet back in those days.
You didn't just sit in your canoe while it's on the rocks and then push off of the rocks like you do with some of the modern canoe materials.
Or just drive your canoe up bow first. Right. You know, a bow person gets out and then yanks on the bow and it knocks the sternsman out of the canoe. I would gingerly pull the canoe up sideways and then stretch and then kind of tiptoe out in the rocks as much as I could. I just hated having wet feet. Mm-hmm. I still hate having wet feet. Mm-hmm. Do anything.
That's why when I'm my spring trips, I'll wear like waders with the Gore-Tex socks. They're amazing. And I can just, you know, then with my spring trips, if I'm hauling over a beaver dam and the water's cold, I'm just like peachy, nice and toasty warm and feet never get wet.
Yeah. You know, for years, and I think it may have ended up ruining my feet, decades, I wore the L.L. Bean high top boots, the leather with the 18-inch leather tops and rubber bottoms, and had a chain link sole on it. And I wore those religiously on all my trips.
You don't wear those anymore?
I don't because I've lost a lot of cartilage, not just on my knees and my shoulders, a lot of my joints, my toe, big toes, of all that clambering over portages. Mm-hmm. A lot of the cartilage really takes a beating on this kind of lifestyle. But my feet have kind of splayed out. They don't really make an LL type boot, bean boot now that fit my feet very well. So I have a variety of other boots that I wear just because the change in the shape of my feet.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that that kind of, you know, injuries or kind of beaten up body parts, cartilage and stuff, do you think that is because of the extensive amount of time that you've spent paddling and portaging canoes through the bush for thousands and thousands of accumulative miles?
Yeah, you know, I've always kept journals on all my trips since I was probably 14, 15. And I tally up like dates, time, distances, all that kind of thing. And I was just talking with my wife, Andrea, a couple days ago, and we said, you know how many times I've actually paddled the Lady Evelyn River? Like, there's a lot of collectors out there. They'll do one river once and then move on. And you really don't really understand or get close to that river, the nuances, until you've paddled it at night, upstream. Right.
I can imagine. And
so I paddled that river over 200 times. And that's a 30-kilometer stretch with 12 portages. So if you look at that one river, and I've done well over 100 rivers. Mm. If you look at that one river, that's 6,000 kilometers.
Just on that one.
Just on that.
Wow.
And if you look at the 12 portages, what's that? What's that, you know, over time?
I'm not going to do the math, but.
That's like 1,000 portages. That distance, there's got to be, you know, well over 1,000.
You know, and that, to me, that's also one of the things that's misleading, because some of those portages, it's not the distance that makes them hard. You can have a portage that's 3 kilometers that's on a perfectly flat old train trestle or something with no hills, and you can have one that's, you know, a third that just beats the hell out of you. And some of those ones on the Lady Evelyn, like, you're coming down inclines like this with jagged rocks where if you drop your canoe, it's going to fly in and potentially break. It's not a cakewalk.
There's been bones broken on those trails, mostly below where our lodge is in the south and north channel. But you know, if I tally up all the distances for, I know I did Lady Evelyn, Andrew and I did it 14 times in one season.
Wow, and why so many times in one
season? Well, we try to utilize as little as possible the float plane for supplies and going in and out. So we often park our vehicle upriver, just at the boundary of the park, and then paddle downriver.
Just to get to your cabin is
just basically to get to the lodge.
Necessary to use the river that many times.
Yeah. So in all the expeditions I've done, I've logged well over 60,000 kilometers now, and you look at the number of trails would be almost at least 25% of that. And I always attribute, 25% of carrying heavy loads over rough portages. Mm-hmm. So that's just the canoeing aspect of what we do. Mm-hmm. So we've got we do sustainable trail building, which is all hand-built stuff. So That's carrying heavy timbers, moving materials, all that hand sculpting with hand tools really does damage to your body after decades of doing it.
The repetitiveness of the same motion?
Yeah, and we've put in thousands of meters of hiking trails.
I mean, essentially, you're a professional athlete of a sort, right? So at anybody who's played, who's done any physical, which is really a lot of the time the natural way of being. Like our ancestors probably would have survived through all kinds of injuries that they dealt with throughout time. But anybody who's doing a physical activity that much is probably going to wind up with a couple injuries over time.
Well, hernia. I've been there. Appendix. I'm going on my third titanium replaced joint. Mm. But it's funny you mentioned that. I have a trainer, and it's Harrow Fitness out of Huntsville. He's trained some professional athletes and Olympians. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to work towards keeping up my strength for the next operation, which is a shoulder replacement. And he says, you know what, Hap, you're going on 73. He says, you're my poster boy. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We have a lot of younger guys in here in worse shape than you are. Makes me feel good. I don't purposely go out. I don't do weightlifting. I don't do this. It's just the lifestyle that my wife and I lead. It takes a lot of energy in whatever we do, whether we're guiding trips or just getting supplies into the cabin. And those where the plane lands. We still have to carry over portages to get our clients, our guests, and all the materials in and supplies in to run a lodge for 5 months. Mm-hmm. So it wears on you. I mean, that's it's the mileage, but I have no regrets. I wouldn't change it for the life of me. And it becomes at over 50. My wife is just getting knee problems and other problems that I had when I hit 50, and it's. For me, it's been 20 years of managing chronic pain, which to me, it's like old friends, except that you can't get rid of them, because maybe they stay a little bit longer than you really want them to. Mm-hmm. So, but it's amazing what they can do, for joints. I have two replaced knees and I could not walk.
Wow.
I was disabled for months before I got both my knees done. And it was almost 10 years between the two of them, having them replaced. So they don't wear out exactly the same. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, my wife and we'll still do, double black diamond skiing or mountain biking, even with replaced joints. Like I say, it's amazing what they can do today.
Yeah, amazing. Yes. Where do you ski?
We've skied, Whistler, Blackcomb, Mount Baker, out in the townships, northeast states.
Yeah. 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 Cool. I didn't know you were into that as well.
Haven't for a few years. Pandemic kind of put a halt to a lot of that stuff. So we have ski trails at our properties. We cross country ski.
Yeah. I find cross-country skiing to be very, very challenging, personally. I guess I'm more of like a snowshoe guy. I love getting out in winter and stuff like that. And I remember the first time I learned on a lake, so flat, maybe some snow to break and all that kind of stuff. And then I'm going out with a buddy of mine on this cross-country ski trails around Huntsville. And he's like, well, I'm taking out Jim Baird, He's like, this adventure, I got to do something good, right? And I'm like, go easy on me, Nate, And he's like, okay, I just got so hurt. I just was like, I would just stand there and my feet would just be like, fly out from under me. And I just, boom, land on my butt. I got a concussion from landing on my ass. And then he got us lost. And then I'm sitting around with this headache, concussed, puttering around the woods in the pitch black. Well, my buddy got us lost. And I'm like, I don't think I like cross country skiing. I just, I think I'm just never going to learn it. I think that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. See, I learned very young at cross country skiing. So we, my wife and I do both. And with our trails at home, I love, packing them down with, we have traditional shoes and I prefer those to breaking trail, especially in deep snow. I mean, the tech shoes, I actually tried the field tested the first, they were, I think, the first commercially made tech shoes, which were actually mountaineering, for mountaineering. They weren't made for like general, you know, consumer use. Until
those are the ones with a metal frame. They have frame, but a regular.
Yeah, it was a Sherpa brand. I don't think they're available anymore. Sherpa, they supplied for the 6 months I spent up at the cabin with the two kids when they were in diapers. So yeah, they gave us snowshoes to test out, and I still use them as a reference to, people ask, well, what snowshoes should I buy? And I always say, well, it's all about flotation. I mean, you can buy tech shoes and go on groomed trails without any trouble. But if you try to break through or try to pack in deep snow, then you don't want traditional shoes because you'll have twice as much flotation.
Also, I notice on thin ice, the traditional shoes don't have those spikes. They don't put so much pressure and it spreads your weight out a bit more that you can actually walk over thin ice. As you know, in Tomogamy, a lot of the portage trails come in or go out, whichever way you're going, at the mouth of some sort of stream or some sort of moving water where the water can be a little bit thinner too.
But
you got to admit those crampons that are on, like I have a pair of MSR, I have both, right? I have three, but I have a pair of what are they called? MSR Lightning Ascent.
Yeah.
Man, are they good. You just walk right up an ice hill where you'd be just dickered if you had traditional shoes. You gotta just walk right up, right? Like for that kind of stuff there, you can't beat them, you know?
Yeah, well, they were designed initially for mountaineering, for icy slopes.
Oh, these are the Sherpa ones.
Sherpa ones. Okay, well, they're the same design as you see today. They're just it's the same like a neoprene decking with anodized aluminum frames, and not much has changed. Yeah. And that was just around the year 1999, I think they came out, 1988, 99, when I got those snowshoes to test out. And I like them for certain things. Great for for ski backpacking. Winter camping, because they're compact. You know, if you have to pack a campsite down or just collect firewood and that, they're nice and light. But or for snow, if you're in snowmobiling, snowmobilers love them because they're for safety. You know, they can strap on without sticking out too far.
Right.
But it's funny.
Well, you can wear them while snowmobiling.
Well, no.
Okay.
No. While snowmobiling, you'll attach them onto the back.
Okay, gotcha.
Your load for safety.
So they're not, just in case you need them. So you have, okay.
Although I've had snowshoes on and they came in really handy. When I spent the winter up at our cabin on Lady Evelyn in April. I know the ice was just coming off the river and I was getting anxious to get the canoe out. So I remember pushing the canoe. I was wearing my crampon type snowshoes, running with and pushing the canoe across thin ice very fast because it was breaking underfoot, but and then pushing it to open water and then paddling for 20 feet and then running it up on the ice and then getting out and then running with my snowshoes again. So
Did you keep 1 foot? So you didn't keep 1 foot in the canoe and like push?
I actually kept, I would actually paddle. I would straddle the gunnels of the canoe. I wouldn't get in the canoe. I would straddle the back and then it was very awkward looking, but
it
got me to where I was going.
Yeah.
And if anybody, I actually filmed that, but I don't know where the film went way back in that.
That was at Cabin Falls.
Cabin Falls. Yeah.
And that's where you run your, Cabin Falls eco tourism business out of, right?
Yeah. For 5 months. Yeah. We go in mid May and then we close up after Thanksgiving.
Yeah. What a beautiful spot. I remember you gave us a bit of a tour when you were there and you had just finished doing a lot of work on it. Gorgeous kind of interconnected walkways because it's very rugged, rocks and stuff. And what a spot though that is. And you mentioned magic before, which instantly gave me goosebumps as soon as you said that, because I remember the way that you described the trip into those falls where your cabin is. It's, in your book, The Cabin, it made me realize it made me think magic is real. Somebody asked me about that the other day about when I write. I haven't written nearly as much as you, but I do write articles and I love it in my films. And so he said, what are you trying to do? And I said, I want people to believe that magic is real, you know, and in a way, right? On whatever scale and whatever level. And I feel like that is what really resonates for me with what you do and your feelings and connection to places like Temagami in this wild country. The whole story, the Nastwagon, like the trails, the ancient 5,000-year-old trails, is that there is a magic in it that you want people to discover. You want that magic to kind of overtake them. I don't know if you could describe it in a similar way or you know, what are your feelings surrounding a place like Cabin Falls, a place like Temagami, and all the things that excite you and interest you about it and make you want to protect it?
Well, it's an interesting topic because I look at today and I mean, there's so many changes, whether it's gear or even attitudes, why we even go out there. Things have changed a lot. And I know for myself, it's something I explained to my guests and those who want to not just survive in the wilderness, but want to enjoy living in the wilderness. I look at that as sort of a transition point that you have to reach and get to and open your mind. And it's mostly through experience. And the more time, and you know this, Jim, is that the more time you spend out there, the more magic presents itself. Mm-hmm. The more things that you have no explanation for, but mm-hmm. they're real. Mm-hmm. And that's everything from understanding especially how the indigenous look at things. I mean, they look at Northern Lights, for example. We look at almost everything scientifically. And they look at it more in an organic sense, how it connects them to whatever, whether it's inanimate or animate. It all has purpose and meaning and connectivity.
Well, that's how the Anishinaabe Mohan language is set up, animate and inanimate, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at their language. That's a whole other story. You could go into mm-hmm. long lengths. Why did they anglicize a lot of the names, you know, across Canada, especially in Temagami? You know, mm-hmm. why did they do that? But that transition from survival to outdoor living depends on your divorcing the notion that you can beat nature. Mm-hmm. And you read today, you look at some videos, mm-hmm. and it's all about, well, I conquered this river and I beat the weather and all that stuff. But you mm-hmm. never really conquer it. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll conquer some of your fears, but you'll never really understand that connective tissue mm-hmm. that presents itself once you open that door and then realize that, you know, you're there, you're a visitor, really, because most of us don't spend enough time outside the box to be really good at it. So, you know, but there are times, the more times you get out of that box and enjoy nature on its mm-hmm. terms, that's where the magic begins. Mm-hmm. And you get into a comfort zone where you can accommodate all of the things that those basic tenets of survival just become second nature. Mm-hmm. And then you start concentrating on all those other nuances that make magic happen out there. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to me through almost like death experiences, mm-hmm. near-death experiences. I've shared some of those in my book, but my wife, she shakes her head because she's pulled my sorry ass out of the water a few times mm-hmm. to rescue me.
Nothing that can make you feel more alive than almost dying.
Well, I always say, you know, I wake up every day and I open my eyes and I think, wow, that's a bonus, another bonus day for me. Mm-hmm. And I said, I've done some pretty stupid things. I look back at the time when, you know, there was not a lot of even self-help stuff out there. There was some historical books on adventures and like Boy Scout type stuff and
camp, American Boys camp, Handy Book.
Yeah, I think Lester Griswold, and there was Bradford Angier mm-hmm. had a book out, and I read all that stuff, and it was all pretty pretty basic scout stuff mm-hmm. And survival. It was all good stuff, mm-hmm. but it there was a lot left out with, like you say, well, how do I get that magic in my life rather than just surviving with all these, you know, basic skills. I always tell people, look, living in the outdoors, it's maybe 25% hard skills and the rest is psychology, you know, how you deal with. And I think, well, you know that better than most. How do you survive? Especially the hardest thing for people to do, especially white Caucasians, European Caucasians for this country, to sit still for any length of time. And you can, I'm sure you know all about that. And that's one of the hardest things to do. And, and I mean, you look at our indigenous people, in the far north, in particular, the Inuit, they'll just sit still and let weather take its course without moving, you know, because they know that, you know, they have it in their makeup that they can't beat what's out there, and it's just tempting fate. And so they sit and they'll wait out a 3-day, 4-day blizzard. Whereas, you know, we have a tendency, well,
what time? When are we leaving? What time are we leaving?
Exactly.
It's not about time that dictates your travel. And, I remember that was one of the things when we were on the show alone, there was, you know, basically no rules except one rule that if you built a boat, you had to use a satellite texting device to tell them when you were going to go out on this boat, you know, and they'd always want to know what time we were going to go. And it was such a pain in the butt because we were not living on this kind of structure like these producers were. And they were doing it for safety. They wanted to have a boat a couple kilometers away that in case you dumped in this rickety boat that you built with wire and sticks that they could get you before you died, right?
Yeah.
But I just remember being out there and having this clashing of this, like, people that were these producers from LA that were, you know, everything needs to be done in a New York minute, and then just not understanding that difference. Same thing, again, my experience with Inuit people. We're near Pingualuit Crater in the interior of the Ungava Peninsula, and the weather was really bad, like, you know, and there are these basically guides there that were bringing a large group of high school age kids. I think they just graduated, and all of them got to do this really cool program. If you got good marks, you got to go all around Nunavik and do these neat things. So they went under the sea ice to pick mussels, which I joined them on. And randomly I bumped into them here at Pingualuit Crater. And the animator for this group, she was from Southern Quebec, Montreal, she kept asking, what time? Like, what time are we going to go? And they're just looking outside, and you could tell she's almost getting annoyed because, you know, that there wasn't really any kind of direct answers. And finally, one of them, Noah, who I've stayed in touch with, kind of broke it down to her and was like, you know, it's not about what time, it's not about what your schedule is, it's about, you know, safety and the weather. And I think the difference is, again, psychology, is she's getting worried, what if we run out of food, how are we not going to get home? But they just have been in that situation so many times that they're not worried anymore. You know, I hear what you're saying too, and I can reflect on that a bit into just, there's so many things that are so much more nuanced than what you can really tell a person through language. And it's like, if you go back to what you were learning through the guy from Curve Lake that had a part in mentoring you, so much of it wasn't necessarily spoken. It was just doing and looking at certain, expressions and stuff like that. And until you're really out there understanding it for yourself, it's hard to just read it, man. You can't just YouTube it, right? Or we'll read a skills article.
Yeah. Like I say, things have changed a lot in over the last, 20 years or so. We've only had, GPS since, 1990s?
Yeah, and they weren't even very good back then. You couldn't actually have a map
because the military wouldn't allow, I think, commercial use to come within, 75 meters or 100 meters or something to a location. But going back to, survival programs, I remember not that long ago, plane crashed in Brazil, and the young girls and a baby, they made it through the forest, through the jungle for 40-plus days or something and survived. And I thought, this is true survival because they should have got the producers of Alone to to pay them mm-hmm. for actually surviving that time using their own indigenous skills mm-hmm. and lack of connectivity. They had absolutely nothing to connect them with civilization, or they never knew whether they were going to get rescued or not.
So you mentioned before walking a path when there's no path. Because it sounds like that's almost what these people must have done to know how to walk, essentially, to help or in a straight line. Can you explain what that means a little bit more?
Yeah. It's interesting. As a trail, you know, I've been building trails. I've been pathfinding and locating old portages. Some of them are centuries old, and still finding trails and building trails. So there are natural routes that you would take, knowing the geography, for example, if, mm-hmm. depending on the geography that you're in. I just explained, I know in Lansing, I was talking about Manitoba. It's a good example of the geophysical nature of a province that has like four different zones for traveling or making a path in. There, you know, there's prairie, and then there's the boreal, there's Hudson Bay lowland boreal, and then there's the Arctic tundra. Finding a path, and especially finding a path before we had technology, mm-hmm. is if you sat on a big lake in the far north and you can't see the shore. I mean, you've got the curvature of the earth coming in play mm-hmm. on a lake that may only be 10 or 15 kilometers across. So you really, you know, we still have topographic maps, which some of them haven't been updated, you know, for decades. Mm-hmm. So we had a map and a compass. And just trying to, whether it's a water path or whether it's a land pathway, looking at Canadian Shield, that we're most familiar with is the forested regions of Ontario and into Manitoba and then into Quebec, the rock and pine country many places I had to open or create new pathways. And then how do you do that? And how do you do that so in a sustainable way? And how did the indigenous do that? Where did they put pathways?
How did they know where to, you know, put a portage? Because they don't always go in the best way to put it is not obviously the most obvious way. For example, remember the little culvert you drove over to get here? Mm-hmm. So that's Poverty Bay. I always thought, why is that not called Poverty Lake? Well, it's because just the way the land lies, there's no main inflow to that at all. And so mm-hmm. when the mag goes up, water goes this way through that culvert. When it goes down, water goes this way through mm-hmm. the culvert. Beavers haven't even figured it out yet. They're just building dams on the wrong side. So at the very end of Poverty Bay, which is over this way, you can actually jump on the traditional portage trail and bypass this falls, this rapid, the next rapid, and put in below the lower waterfall and canyon, mm-hmm. which without an aerial survey, without like how did they figure that out?
Yeah.
That's sort of what you're kind of explaining in a way, or are you just kind of more explaining how you can navigate using just the signs around you in the bush?
Yeah. I mean, it's even the physical nature of the ground itself. I mean, a lot of the animals I've put many trails in on deer runs, for example. And they tend to like the upper ridges, just for their own safety. And whereas moose like the lower areas where the vegetation is good feed for them. So and the thing is, well, you also have to look at, well, what's the high water table? Like, is that going to flood out? Is there an intermittent creek there that might flood in the springtime? You don't want to put a trail along through there. And the indigenous peoples probably did not put a trail there because it probably floods out in the spring. Or the beavers may dam up,
right,
like you mentioned, and flood out a portage trail. So they'll usually stick to the high ground or take a roundabout route to get to where they're going. It might be a little bit further. I could go over a map and I could show you many places, even in Temagami, where that's taken place, and in Quebec and in Manitoba.
Mm-hmm. And did finding those trails offer you a window into the mindset of the people that made them?
Well, it did, and been lucky too, because sometimes, and I'll, we mapped out a trail across northern Manitoba, just south of the tree line. That was one of the most fabulous trips I've ever done, and and it had only been traveled by the Dene people decades ago, there was only one trapper that had trapped in that area. And I saw signs. I even saw traps that were still set, and they were set in the late 1940s.
Wow.
In his campsites, everything was so well preserved because of the dry climate, and everything is preserved, really well, especially on top of the eskers, the sand eskers. And
is this the Seal River?
No, this is the Caribou.
Okay, beyond the trees.
Further north, it's a Newellton Lake area. Okay, and then into the tundra. But finding the portages that weren't caribou trails. Some of them, there were traditional trails that were used by the Dene. And the Dene were mostly overland travelers. They crossed the water bodies in these little homemade boats, little banana boats to get across where the caribou crossed. But I know mapping out this route across northern Manitoba and then creating some new trails, not a lot because the caribou actually were the same as say the deer down south. They knew exactly where they wanted to walk. A lot of were on top of the eskers. So we had, I'd follow the eskers along the top of eskers. And then following these old trails, whether they're made by wildlife or indigenous, we'd find tons of old grave sites. All the animals walk the eskers, all of them. And it's like a virtual highway. So that finding ancient tooling sites, way markers, dolmen stones.
What's a dolmen stone?
A dolmen stone is from the Gaelic Dalman, which means table rock. And they're found globally. And
they're in Tomogamy for sure.
They're in Tomogamy. Yeah. And I know several of them that are there. And I know that some canoeists have built fires against some of them. Yeah. I actually cracked one of them in half, which was very sad.
You know the one on that small island on Obabaka on the southern part of the lake?
Right.
I don't know. There's one there that I'm looking at this thing. I'm like, this has been here for a long time.
Yeah. These were places where the First Nation would put offerings of some kind.
Oh, okay.
And I've got photos of some in the far north where...
I just thought it was a good table to use to sit on or whatever.
Well, yeah, some of them, and I don't know if this catches on the camera, but most of these are propped up. The dolmen stones usually have rocks underneath. Mm-hmm. So the cavity underneath would present itself as a place to store offerings.
Oh, okay.
And you'll see some of these are massive. I've got shots with my camera in the far north. Some of these, and you wonder, well, there was one in particular. It had to be five times the size of this table. It was propped neatly on three rocks. And you wonder...
Wow. Well,
was that just a glacial erratic and that was just dropped there on top of these rocks? Or was that somehow maneuvered up? And you look around the size of the trees or maybe the size of your arms. And these are old spruce trees in that kind of scabrous tree line area of northern Canada.
Almost sounds like something Mowat would explain and like the Alban people. I don't know if you've ever read the Farfars. It almost seemed like something like a Norse thing or something. Those huge rocks.
Well, how did they, and how did they, if they used like timbers, how did they lever that rock up to sit on top of the small rocks in such a way? Or even the table rocks that I've seen propped up. I've found offerings, old like spear and arrowhead points and underneath there just, and that.
Yeah.
So these are the things I know that I have found on my travels, getting off or recreating an old trail or making a new trail.
What's that feeling like to find something?
Well,
this
is part of the magic. And,
yes.
Yeah. You see these things and you open your eyes and you think, well, first of all, you don't know how old it is. So you don't know, You don't know, and there's certainly no garbage. Mm-hmm. The only garbage that I found on an Asker was the burial site of one of the chiefs from the Dene chief from the 1940s. He was buried on the top of an Asker standing up because he wanted to be able to watch his ancestors paddle by. And I found that Asker only by accident because we pulled in and very calm day. And we were just exploring the Asker and came across a belt knife, a leather belt knife with a sheath knife, just laid on the top of the Asker. Mm-hmm. And that's testament to how nature preserves it, you know, these type of things in the North. Mm-hmm. That was his sheath mm-hmm. knife that was placed on top of his burial site.
Wow.
And it was a bit of trepidation for the four of us that were there because we felt that we were invading that private space.
Right. Yeah.
And so now we can't stay here. Mm-hmm. We've got to go. And at that moment, a strong wind came up. Mm. And it was just like telling us that, no, this is a private space. This is for indigenous people only. Mm-hmm. And so we got off there and we paddled on. Mm. But that's the kind of magic. Mm. And I've had many, many cases like that over the years.
And you say, well, is it just coincidence or is it not? Or it, is
to
it,
me, it's not coincidence. Yeah. And because of the number of times that this has happened to me, I get on the Thelon, for example, and I wrote a book based on the John Hornby expedition. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with the John Hornby expedition. Which book of yours?
That's Dance of the Dead Men. And
I'm familiar with it, but
I worked a long time on that book, doing the research on that and trying to cover that story in a different manner, mm-hmm. actually putting dialogue to the three men, mm-hmm. Based on that story. And so far I've had a lot of good reviews on that. But going back to the magic of it all is I've been on the Thelon a few times, mm-hmm. and the first time I was on there, we were shooting a story for City TV in Toronto. I was with Bob Hunter, co-founder of Greenpeace, and we were mm-hmm. doing a story on the Thelon basically because they wanted to declassify the Thelon Game Sanctuary because of mining, because of diamond interests. Mm-hmm. So we were doing a story on the Thelon, and of course you have to stop at the Hornby cabin site and graveyard. Mm. So the graveyard's still there. And I remember being filmed and I said, well, I'm going to sit down and have a smoke with John Hornby and the boys, the lads. Mm. And I sat between the grave markers. I had my pipe out and it was a calm day and we're grouped around and they're doing some filming. And as soon as I lit my pipe and that first waft of smoke came out of that pipe, mm-hmm. a strong blast of wind came and it knocked everybody's hat off.
Wow.
And everybody just stopped and said, okay, that's not a coincidence. Mm-hmm. That's just too strange. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
when I was on one of my long solo trips, I love those moments where you kind of just connect where you're almost in a state where you're almost daydreaming, we'll call mm-hmm. it. And what's said to me is, you know, like you're explaining about science, that a lot of people have a more scientific way to explain something. You know, science is always, in a way, eventually going to be able to explain magic, but who's the magician? You know what I mean? Every magic trick that's out there, you can explain how the magic trick is done, is taken place, which is science, but there's still the magician behind it doing it.
Yeah, there's that sleight of hand that we still can't explain. one story that I tell at some of my talks, and I told this in Lansing because we had lots of questions about pictographs. Mm-hmm. And I showed one slide, and it was one of the more powerful drawings or paintings on the blood vein in actually Woodland Caribou Park. And a lot of these sites I had privy to because I'd been working with, I wanted to at least sketch and know where these sites were. They didn't go in my guidebook, because I'll only put pictograph sites in that have already previously been advertised in other documentations. But I had a group with me. I remember, and I was actually filming a mink that had a merganser in its mouth. And I stopped to film it. And I said, well, if you go over to that rock face, I told my group to go over there, but be quiet and I'll catch up to you. Well, I spent more time than I should have. And the group was at this rock face, and it was the painting was of a shaman. And these are very powerful sights. And they were splashing water on it and touching it. And I was just aghast. And I said, oh, no, this is not good. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to do this. And it was my fault because I usually go in first and I go quiet, put some tobacco down. Mm-hmm. I give everybody tobacco so they can do their own personal offering and then leave. Well, they were doing all kinds of stuff. And I just shook my head. This is not good. Mm-hmm. And a huge storm came up within the next 15, 20 minutes. I mean, one of these microburst storms mm-hmm. out of nowhere. And we paddled like crazy to get to the campsite and pitch and tie everything off. Mm-hmm. And trees were coming down around us. And I thought, okay, that's not a coincidence either. Mm. But getting back to the story about pictographs is that everybody wants to know, well, tell me about the pictographs. You know, it's just like Indian graffiti, right? Well, mm-hmm. it's not Indian graffiti. It's mm-hmm. indigenous spirit places. I think they call it harmonic conversion points now, kind of a scientific
harmonic conversion points. That sounds awesome. What does that mean?
I know, and I'm not sure how to translate that, but these were actually sacred places.
You're better off asking you translating a native word, probably.
Yeah, well, these were teaching sites, what they were. Mm. And the shaman, and the word shaman is something that we've kind of labeled a healer of the upright life mm-hmm. is more accurate. Mm-hmm. You weren't supposed to go to these sites without permission mm-hmm. or unless there was some act of healing going on. And I spent a winter on the shores of Lake Superior writing my Missinabe book, and there's a lot of stories about deaths at some of the spiritual sites along the Missinabe, which I was investigating. And I spent a lot of time at Michipicoten Reserve going through all of their folklore, legends, stories. And I was mm-hmm. I actually, off the cuff, I asked one of the elders there, was, okay, we have all these pictographs, these paintings. We can go to the best hardware store and get the best paint, but it'll last maybe 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. on our docks and our houses. Mm-hmm. What's the science behind the bonding agent on these pictographs? And mm-hmm. he just laughed at me and he said, it's not science, it's magic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I knew a little bit about the legends and the folklore, mm-hmm. and I explained this to my audience, and that whether you believe this or not, mm-hmm. It's we have known components for what's used like
ochre,
red ochre, which mm-hmm. is mined in a couple of different places, mm-hmm. Port de Lanfay on the Mattawa, and then there's a couple of places in Killarney. And it was traded amongst some of the native groups, but what's the bonding agent? Okay, mm. that's one component of it.
Fish
it
grease,
could be
maybe?
Egg albumen from gull eggs. It could be bear grease, all sorts of things. But that's still not the bonding agent. Mm. The bonding agent, I was told, well, the Memagwishawak are stone people, and they live within that place of harmonic conversion, or that magical place where it's like an energy place where, and I think it has a lot to do with that healer being able to transport himself. It's like a shaman internet. Because you look at some of the pictographs around the globe, you'll see some similarities, like the Lascaux yes. caves in France, for example, and the symbols on the rocks on the blood vein of bison images are almost identical. And some of the other imagery is identical. Mm-hmm. Shaman internet, but you've got this.
So you think that's a sixth sense, essentially? That's a theory that there's a sixth sense between them that is kind of connecting them, if on maybe a subconscious level or something like that, even that.
Yeah, if you look at like the shaking tent ceremony, which is mm-hmm. and it's almost done in secrecy now, mm-hmm. and that's where the healer, shaman, if you want to mm-hmm. call them shamans, are able to travel outside of their own physical bodies. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I could go on and on about that, but it's something that we know very little of or understand. The healer would be looking at the face of this sort of rock wall that he's chosen because of the energy in that rock wall. And inside the stone people, the Memegwishawak, were conjured out, and they proffered their blood to be mixed with the other agents to make this pasty paint. And that was, of course, put on the rock using hand, fingers, a crushed end of a stick. And then through particular ceremony, that was the bonding agent that adhered that paint to the rock for thousands of years.
No kidding.
Whether you believe that or not,
yeah.
I don't disbelieve it because...
How could you ever really prove it, though? We're like, okay, well, let's try to take these two things and we'll wait 5,000 years and see how it turns out. Like, how are you gonna test that out, right? Like, to see if it would work without that, so, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't think they've come up with a scientific rationale for you know what the bonding agent is.
Yeah.
I mean, I've visited a lot of indigenous spiritual sites on my travels, and all of them have a story and that resident magic to them. Mm-hmm. And I just shake my head. And I mean, I've had ghost experiences in the past. Mm-hmm. I know that there, you know, is another dimension there. Mm-hmm. I've had personal experiences in that sense. I've seen a lot on my winter camping trips and things out of the corner of my eyes, you know, all these, who knows, you know, maybe Wendigo is actually Sasquatch. I mean, better ask Les Stroud. Maybe he could explain.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever watch his Survivor Man Bigfoot?
No, I'm not a huge Bigfoot. I don't follow a lot on social media, to tell you the truth. I'm so busy.
You've done some trips with him.
Doing artwork, guiding, or running our lodge, or building trails. Mm-hmm. It's tough for me to get on social media. I have to go on social media. I do follow some people. I find, some people, reasonably interesting. And it's good that people are getting outside for the right reasons. I don't do a lot of social media, and I wonder what did we ever do, back in the day, at campsites, we didn't play with our, all our gadgets and things. We read Louis L'Amour novels around the campfire and drank bitter tea.
Well, I can't even imagine what it was like. I remember even when I was a kid, there was no internet, there was pay phones. And it's such a pain in the butt when you can't get a hold of someone in 5 seconds nowadays. Like back in the day, that was normal. We weren't all panicking, thinking everyone was in trouble when you had to wait for a payphone. And sometimes the guy on the phone was yakking for an hour and you had to wait out there still with your arms folded, tapping your foot. You know, everybody got by all right.
Yeah, I thought, running a business, the outfitting company that my wife and I ran in Temagami, for years. We relied on the phone, and the fact that we had a fax machine was about as high tech as you could get back then.
Right.
And you relied on that, to keep in touch with and contact, your guests. But now, you look at Cabin Falls Ecolodge. We, by accident, we're 50 kilometers from the nearest cell tower.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in the Rock Knob Uplands. We're in the highest points in Ontario where we are. And we have a trail. I used to use the ridge behind the cabin, the original cabin, back in the Ranger days in the 70s, because our two-way radios wouldn't work unless you climbed a high hill or climbed a high tree. And so we revived that trail, and it's now our what we call the office. It's a half a kilometer, and it's a pretty high climb. And I remember taking some guests. We had a dozen guests, and everybody has their iPhones for taking pictures these days. So everybody's got that in their back pocket. So we're walking up to this high point behind the lodge, and then everybody's phone started pinging,
No kidding.
I'm getting messages. Well, that can't be. I can drive two kilometers from my home in Muskoka, and I've got no power.
Right.
Whereas, we're almost 50 kilometers from the nearest Bell or Rogers Tower on Highway 11 corridor. And so that's allowed us to do business on a daily basis, and keep in touch with our guests and clients. And although we try to get people to disconnect from all of that stuff, as they connect with nature, reconnect,
right.
Everybody ends up walking up that hill to check messages. Tell you the truth. Oh, I'm going to put my phone away the first day they arrive.
Right.
I'm not going to take it. But you know, after a couple of days, I wonder how Junior's doing at school and or at camp. And you know, or I've got an aging grandmother or aunt. So they go up and they check it, and it helps us because of that connection that people seem to really need these days. So, but it's nice. I mean, we can put our car keys and our wallets on a shelf for 5 months up there, pretty much. And, and park our car. Nice to park our vehicles because we don't drive anywhere for almost half a year.
Everything's canoe power only, I guess.
Pretty much. And I do come out on occasion to do some trail building work. And my wife, she's there with we hire students to come in and help during the summer. And we have a lot of friends that just look at it as a vacation to come up and they'll help carry supplies in or help move lumber down river and that kind of thing.
That's cool. What do you do with your clients when they come in to stay in this? The spot has got to be one of the most beautiful spots in Ontario easily.
Yeah, it's even going upriver to meet either people will come in on the plane, a float plane. So we paddle up and we have to nurse them down 2.5 kilometers downriver. And a lot of these people don't have canoe skills. So, they'll be my partner in the bow. We'll run down the rapids, we'll portage. We have canoes salted along the portage, so we don't have to carry portage, just gear. Mm-hmm. And they think, running a class 1 rapid is like doing this great whitewater trip.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of adrenaline and then lining up, when they go upstream, we teach those skills going up and down. So that's one thing that we do. It's just getting to the lodge. Mm-hmm. By the time they get there, people are tired because they've just come from inside the box, jumped on a float plane or paddled in and stay over for a couple of days. And they get there and they look over the falls from the main deck and they, wow, this place is magical. And so we plan, whoever comes in, everybody gets their own cabin, basically. We can sleep about 14 people there comfortably. Mm-hmm. And people usually come in small groups, so they each get a cabin and they each have a bathhouse. It's probably the fanciest outhouse you'll find in the north.
Nice.
So we sit down with them and we go through, well, what's your skill levels? What kind of itinerary would you like to build into your days here? Mm-hmm. And so we have 8 waterfalls. We can go to 8 different waterfalls. 5 on the Lady Evelyn. There's actually 7 on the Lady Evelyn that we can go to. And then 1, which is a small waterfall going up to Dry Lake Ridge. Dry Lake Ridge is one of the highest points in Ontario. It's a great day trip because we go upriver and stop, look at, do some photographs around the little waterfall that comes through there. Great moose watching trip going in to do the climb. We keep that trail maintained. It's one of the best hikes and viewpoints. It's a 650 vertical foot drop.
Wow. And so I don't think I've been to that one. I've been up Maple Mountain before.
We can actually see Maple Mountain to the north from that ridge.
Yeah, so on that same trip when we bumped into you the one time, we came around and then we worked our way in and did the climb there. It's a bit of a side adventure, to get in there and back to Lady Evelyn Lake, but it's well worth it.
Yeah, it's the nice thing about Temagami is that you can get off the river, and I remember back when I was a park ranger and working in, mapping out the initial boundaries for the park is that we had to make sure that the viewscapes were protected as best as we could. It was a hard fight. Mm-hmm. Because, loggers in the industry say, well, canoeists never get off the water. Mm-hmm. But in Temagami, we've got at least 20 different hiking trails that go up to high points. So the last thing you want to see when you get up to a top of a ridge is, these massive clear cuts. We did manage to protect quite a few areas.
That's awesome, yeah.
For viewpoint protection. Yeah. But Temagami, that's the unique thing about Temagami is these high points. But that's... Dry Lake is one trip that we do. Every day is a different trip to a waterfall we do wild swimming as well. We have a 40-foot cliff that you can jump off of.
Nice.
Or shorter ones.
That's fun.
Yeah, I'm a dipper. I'll walk in. I don't like jumping or diving in.
Right, right.
People love swimming there. You can swim in and around the falls, get underneath a couple of the waterfalls.
Yeah.
And just the nature of photography there. We're in probably the best places to see ancient pine, ancient red and white pine, mm-hmm. the last big stands in North America. So the trails wind through all of this ancient forest, and people are just amazed at, mm-hmm. at the size and density of this forest that's never been cut. And then we take them to a place that has been cut mm-hmm. back in the 40s and 50s. There's an old Camboos camp mm-hmm. That we have a little trail around, and it's all semi-preserved by nature, what's left of them. You can see the foundations, and you can mm-hmm. see the stoves, some of the accoutrement that was there that they used in the, you know, in the old days. And
that's kind of cool.
Horseshoes that from the they used to pull all the timber by horse.
Yeah,
and so people see that transition from, and they know the transition from horse-drawn logging mm-hmm. to high-impact logging done today, which mm-hmm. is done, which is we're still trying to mm-hmm. Curb that a little bit in the periphery of the wilderness quarry.
Right? I don't think most people realize that pretty much the entire province of Ontario, anywhere where water connected to the Great Lakes, has all been logged. So I don't think people really have an understanding of how precious these last few pockets are, you know, because they don't realize that there at one time were these gorgeous, you know, gigantic pines mm-hmm. everywhere, much more common.
Yeah, and they say, doing my research on the Rivers of the Upper Ottawa book, my guidebook, mm-hmm. There's so much timber taken off from Quebec in mm-hmm. Ontario. A lot of that went to the States, the railroad that went straight south across the border. And, you know, up until the early 70s, we used to think that was an inexhaustible supply of timber. Mm-hmm. And then we started seeing the depletion, because that was also the birth of the environment movement.
Right.
You know, my friend, late friend Bob Hunter, was co-founder of Greenpeace off the West Coast in 72. And in 72, that was Save the Maple Mountain Committee was formed mm-hmm. In East Central Canada. Mm-hmm. Temagami was an international fight mm-hmm. That put the wilderness area on the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, Endangered Spaces list. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to get it back on now because of some of the things going on, mm-hmm. trying to create or establish that as a UNESCO mm-hmm. heritage site. It's got all the right formula for that.
Oh, that would be amazing. It's hard sometimes to explain to people why some of these things are so precious. I don't know what it is, but when I look at a white pine, white pines are unique amongst conifers because of how they grow, right? Mm-hmm. They have that very sculpted look, like you see in Group of Seven paintings, because every year only one branch grows up the top and then it gets pushed with the wind. That's a way that you can tell direction, right? They're more
natural navigation.
Yep. Point southeast if your prevailing winds are northwest, right?
Exactly, yeah.
But there's just something about those giant towering pines that exist in a place like Temagami, just to look at them, mm-hmm. that just to me seem magical. And also just the network of 5,000-year-old trails. So like prehistoric mm-hmm. footpaths where people's feet were walking, carrying a canoe over your head to literally put your foot in what might be the exact same spot as someone did. That cultural significance. And just, I don't know what it is, but just the backstory, the primordial nature of it all. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but there's just something so cool and special that I hope more people are able to, and it's not something you can just tell people, hey, you know, the Temagami is really special. These, you know, for most people, they don't get it. They have to be able to kind of drink it in a way, I think.
Well, that's the nice thing about Cabin Falls Ecolodge, that we do, people are dying, starving for information on mm-hmm. that kind of thing, that as they're reconnecting with nature in mm-hmm. multiple ways, they learn about one of Canada's precious wilderness areas. And if you look at wilderness and being in the environment movement, since, you know, back as early as the early 1970s, mm-hmm. We did a lot of things wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying wrong, but we approached environmental protection from a philosophical, emotional.
Like what I'm talking about, where nobody gives a
well, I mean, the industry, you know, yeah. they know the dollar value of a tree, right? So we've had to kind of bastardize our sensitivities towards nature. So, so now if you look at wilderness as a commodity, as any commodity, as it becomes scarce, it becomes more valuable.
Right.
We haven't quite clicked on to that value. What does it mean? Because we don't experience it enough to know its value. If you look at, you know, we always point the fingers at other countries about deforestation, like the Brazilian rainforest, for example. And many of the largest clear cuts are found in Northern Ontario in the boreal, and that's sweeping across from Quebec and the Maritimes and all the way through and into Manitoba. Mm-hmm. If you Google Earth that and from space photography, you'll see those huge, huge plots of boreal, but nobody goes there. Nobody flies over it. Nobody drives through it. And even if they paddle some of the rivers, there's a thin veneer of trees where they don't get off the river. Not like Temagami, not like in the hilly country where you can actually see the clear cuts. Mm-hmm. These are massive amounts of forest being
And removed. Think about just, you know, the boreal forest, it's proven can almost control the weather, like it has like a collective consciousness.
Huge carbon sink.
And also they, you know, some of these trees will release terpenes into the air to help it rain. You know, they'll band together and decide to starve out the red squirrels when the red squirrels population gets too high and is eating, you know, too many of their seeds, right? And you got to wonder, does that have to do, sure, it's hard to say, well, all these forest fires we're having, is that deforestation? Sure, there's no trees to burn if it's a clear cut, but you know, they grow back densely. If there's less trees to release terpenes into the atmosphere to try to get it to rain, that's just the tip of the iceberg with this stuff. But I just wonder how much of these fires that we're having is caused by, you know, forestry practices.
Well, I think a lot of it, I know the big fire in Temagami was because of the amount of slash that was left on the ground. Now they have prescribed burns, and in a lot of cases they get out of control themselves.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, you know, wholly dependent on weather and wind, whether they're successful or not. And I think there's a number of factors. Well, climate change, and we've had weather anomalies in the past. Mm-hmm. I've never seen it. I've talked to some. Guys even older than myself, believe it or not, who cannot remember a winter like we're having now.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah. The one thing is like, oh, we're breaking records from the 1930s. So in the 1930s, there was some winter that was pretty warm, which, you know, some people might use that the wrong way and say like, that means climate change is completely false or whatever. But it does... You know, obviously, human caused climate change is making a difference. But if there's any hope that I hang on to, it's that this is also just a really weird El Nino year. It's happened in the past, and maybe we're still going to get a good winter again, because I'm going to have to find a new culture. I like to get out there ice fishing, winter camping, all of the things, man. Like, this year was so weird. It was so warm. There was no ice. The ice was dangerous. People were falling through the ice all over the place. And I feel like it was a prolonged shoulder season where you don't have any of these activities that I've grown up doing. I could barely even take my kid. He's two and a half. I want to teach him how to skate. And I keep bringing him, keep going to pick him up and bringing his skates and getting to the rink, and it's like melted and closed and just bizarre.
Yeah, no, I've only skied once this year, and it's been sad.
It's like no snow, you know?
Yeah, but I have to admit I've been enjoying the warm weather.
Well, so. At the same time, when there was enough ice, I went winter camping with my kids. It was like -30 degrees. Yeah. Like, I'm not even wearing gloves the whole time. I'm like, okay, well, maybe that's not so bad in some ways.
Yeah, but I think of all the hot tenders out there. And I remember I did some teaching for Outward Bound, some winter survival courses. And I just remember some of bitter, bitter cold. Mm-hmm. And working with David Suzuki's Nature of Things on the coldest week of the winter.
Wow.
Back in 1985, I think it was. And the cinematographer, you know, having to sleep with the canisters of film and batteries in the sleeping bag to keep things warm. Minus 40 at night. I think the lowest temperature this winter has only been like minus 16.
We had for sure minus 20 here, but you're
about 10 kilometers further north than I am.
But that's the first year we haven't. Yeah, that's the first year we haven't had, you know, minus 30 at least for one day. You know,
several days. Yeah,
yeah. Usually a week or two, it hovers around the minus 25, minus 30, depending.
Yeah,
you know. It's wild.
Well, I remember helicoptering into my my cabin up in the falls, Cabin Falls.
Yeah.
1 year, and having to jump out of the helicopter at 30 feet because he was afraid to go any lower. Mm-hmm. It was weird throwing a bag out and
into the water.
It was in the winter.
Okay. Well, okay. That's what I thought. But then I'm like, what are you jumping into?
Yeah. No. And then I was just going to ski out from there and snowshoe up. Mm. And so after 2 days, we had a warm spell. And for 2 weeks, it stayed around above freezing.
Mm.
Lost all the snow. It's just what you see out here today.
Was that a January thaw, you think?
February.
Oh.
And which is unheard of, February thaw. I had to wait until everything froze up again to be able to walk the 90 kilometers to get out.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's an anomaly, and but I mean, we're seeing trends now that are, there's so many changes in weather. Even as a guide, I have trouble, predicting. I could tell my guests, my clients on a wilderness trip, what the weather's going to be like for 2 or 3 days because of weather patterns and wind, breeze, everything. And now, you turn your head and it changes. And it's harder to predict because things change so quickly now.
I've been noticing we've been having these crazy fluctuations. Some people, I've mentioned to a couple of people, they're like, what, really? But I think it's like been obvious for almost 2 years with a bit of a gap in between. But it'll be like minus 20, then 2 days later, plus 8, then minus 16, then warm. And overall, just way warmer in general.
Yeah.
Super weird, man. We didn't even know what to do with the maple syrup this year because usually it's like a late winter, early spring thing. And this year.
What does that do with, the normal spring vegetation, for example, the insects, all of these things that kind of wait until when are the peepers going to start peeping?
They're getting a bad sleep. It's like when someone keeps waking you up and you have to keep falling back to sleep, maybe.
Yeah. So, and bears, are bears going to come out early? They're going to be popping their heads out thinking,
probably
as soon as that water starts dripping on their head down in those cavities, they're going to start crawling out. I don't know what the heck. And then we're going to, like you say, we're probably going to get a blast of winter yet.
Yeah. And then we could see large die-offs with certain species, certain plants.
Hard to say. Yeah. How that's going to affect.
Also the blue-green algae could be an issue with no real snow runoff and more stagnant water, warmer water and all that too.
Yeah. Another thing too that I've never heard of before is zombie fires.
Really? I've never heard of, no.
That's a new terminology, but these are the fires, especially in BC. Uh-huh. These are the fires that burn underground in the mulch and the peat. All these big dead trees, of course, it's excellent burning peat.
It just slowly smolders.
So it's smoldering. Mm-hmm. And right now they're seeing all of these little smoke chimneys coming out from last year's fires. And it won't take anything to get these.
So the winter's not killing the zombie fires are slowly smoldering all winter.
Smoldering,
that's crazy. That's scary.
So I don't think it's gonna be a terrible fire season again this year.
You think so?
I think so. I have that feeling.
Just because of the lack of snowfall across the country.
Lack of snowfall, unless we get a lot of spring rain. Mm-hmm. And the amount of logging that's going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, the water isn't retained. I've noticed that in some of the river flows.
Mm-hmm.
With a lot of the upper sections of the rivers, heavy logging, especially outside the parks, just to the periphery of some of these parks and some of the headwaters areas, there's no water retention. So whatever water more snow there is, it flushes through really fast.
Right. So and the rivers
the
rush.
The rivers dry.
Yeah.
It flush out really quickly.
Mm, there are ways that they could try to work to cut like barriers from around towns and stuff like that, that they're going to try to, you know, the government's talking about working with logging companies to try to cut in such a way where it makes gaps in between fire zones and not fire zones to try to protect communities, people's houses and stuff like that. So there's, you know, a way they could sort of use logging to effectively try to protect damage to property and stuff like that too, is sort of what they're talking about doing.
Well, that's they're going to have to. I mean, they've already started that in Muskoka and a lot of places. They've actually enlarged some of the culverts under roads. Mm-hmm. Road systems have been washing up because the culverts are too small to handle all that microburst storms that we've been getting, heavy torrential downfalls that have been washing out roads. So they've been slowly replacing the old culverts and putting in massive culverts now to hold that. And the same with, as you say, berms around towns to curb wildfires.
Crazy, man. Well, I'm sure you've seen it. Not that, you know, because you've, you know, no offense or anything, but been around a little bit longer than me, you know. I'm just a young guy.
I'm okay with that, Jim.
But you've probably seen it. Even when I was a kid, we used to go drive on Lake Simcoe between Christmas and New Year's. Now you need to take a boat out.
Hey, in April, I took my Jeep all over to Lake Temagami.
Yeah.
Just bombing around. It was mid-April.
Yeah.
And now we're getting, you know, the lake. Lakes are free of ice sometimes in mid-April up north.
Wow. Yeah, that's majorly different. Well, Hap, if there's – it's been a great chat, by the way. And I'm sure we could go on more. But, is there – first of all, when you are somebody that's made your life out of – you know, conservation, the outdoors. We talked a bit about Earth Roots, which is an environmental, basically it's a group of people that are trying to make a difference when it comes to conservation. Your books, your guiding, all these things, you know, at what point did you realize, okay, this is something that I have to do. This is where my passions lie. I have to try to make a life out of this, essentially as a entrepreneur, because that's almost kind of the only way one can do it. And is there anything that you would share with, you know, somebody that maybe is looking at following in footsteps similar to the ones you've taken as an artist, as a writer, as somebody who's managed to spend their entire lives in the outdoors and also made a living from it while at the same time making a difference?
It's interesting. It's a good question because I get asked that quite a bit. I am so fortunate. I built my own lifestyle. Basically, my wife and I did. She was going for her doctorate in ethics, and then she decided that, she became a trail builder and a lodge owner and an incredible designer, interior designer. And she found out that that's where her passion was. But that was her connectivity to nature as well. So. Mm-hmm. I've been so lucky. I was not corporate material. I knew that from the beginning. I went into my own business after high school as an illustrator. But I passed up a high-paying job for Simpson Sears in Toronto as a catalog artist, 6 days a week, office in Toronto.
Wow.
It was an incredible wage. And I said, and I remember sitting across the desk like you and I, and he said, well, when can you start? And I said, what do you mean? And it was near canoeing season, right? He said, well, you have to start in May something. And I said, well, I can't. I got a canoe trip to go on.
Right.
so he sat back in his chair and he said, it's not going to work out.
Yeah.
So, no, it wasn't the money that was important to me. It was being out there. And just being satisfied with what I have. My wife and I, we feel we have a lot. We work hard for what we've got. And we've got a lot out of nature, and we try to put as much back into nature as we can, whether it's in the books that I write, podcasts, people we take up to our lodge. It's a great way to disconnect. And I say to people, before you can reconnect, you got to disconnect. And I see there's a lack of mindfulness in today's outdoor trade, not just outdoor trade, but almost everywhere. I think people, because whether it's a population thing, whether it's social media is kind of disconnected us from that social gathering face-to-face conversation. Mm-hmm. Nobody writes letters anymore, kind of thing.
Right.
Nobody punctuates their emails. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world of emojis and you don't understand half the times when people write to you and you get angry, but don't get angry. I didn't mean that on my email. Mm-hmm. So we've got to drift away from all that mm-hmm. stuff that we're connected to.
Mm-hmm. It's a good feeling when you do, isn't it?
Oh, it's a great feeling. When we're at our lodge and we get people to put their phones up, mm-hmm. Which is tough to do because mm-hmm. people are entrenched in being able to contact people right away and knowing what's going on around us mm-hmm. immediately. So we forget to just sit back and let things take their course mm-hmm. and enjoy nature by just observation mm-hmm. and doing it in a healthy way and a mindful way. I see a lot of young people coming out of outdoor ed schooling and wanting to get into the guiding business, but there's a lot to learn mm-hmm. and it's not just the skills you have to learn, but it's knitting personalities together under duress, mm-hmm. which is tough. As you know, sometimes it's hard when you get a group of people. Yeah. They don't like the bugs. They don't like the weather. They don't like the hard work. Mm-hmm. But they're out there. But they don't spend a lot of time out there to mm-hmm. be good at it. Mm-hmm. So that's a tough. That's what being a guy is tough. You have to be a doctor, a raconteur, a chef, a psychotherapist, all these things.
Yeah.
But there's the romance.
A servient leader.
Yeah.
As they call it.
And knit all these people together and keep them safe yeah. and happy. And
did it take guts to sit there and be like, I got a canoe trip? Like 9.9 out of 10 people would be like, take the safe path to work at this good paying job. You know, even if you probably made more money, which probably in the end you probably wouldn't have, you know, from my experience, just because, you know, you would be wishing that you were doing what you were doing the whole time, but it must have taken some balls to go on this path of like not knowing how you're gonna necessarily make ends meet or pay for this or that or the other thing, as opposed to this kind of safer passage. Did it take guts at the time when you were yeah. sitting there and you decided I'm going on the canoe trip, not on this dream job where you'd probably be one out of the only freaking artists in the city that actually is making a good amount of money and not starving, you know?
Yeah. I mean, not everybody can do the things that my wife and I do. We realize that even when we hire our students, we have to remember they're not going to work as hard as we are, but they're going to really enjoy what they do and they're going to learn a lot. That's our personal nature. Carving your own path has always been important to me mm-hmm. from an early age. As an artist, I started as an artist and tripper, mm-hmm. and a lot of our guests are retired mm-hmm. at this point in their lives, but they've gone through their lives almost disconnected from nature. Mm-hmm. And they realize that what they should have done a lot earlier in their lives, which is possible. It's hard when you're trying to raise a family mm-hmm. and trying to pay the bills. It gets harder to get outside to get that time in nature. But this is something that you have to persevere with. You have to you almost have to make the time.
Right.
You know, yeah. Shut the TV off
I do that. I have all kinds of things on the go and it's tough where with my, like, you know, what if I make most of my money on YouTube? What if they just pull the plug one day? Right. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I still have to, I live in an area where I have access to that, mm-hmm. but sometimes you got to just kind of shut that aside and just get out there. And those are just when you come back and you feel so much more fulfilled.
Yeah. There's a huge fear in mm-hmm. leaving that comfort zone. You have to admit, I mean, even Andrew and I, you know, we'll get to that point sometimes, you know, and then we have to remind ourselves, well, we've got things to do. We're in a really nice place right now, especially in the wintertime when all our hard physical labor is done and then we have the winter could kind of hibernate. And we have to really be careful that we could just become couch potatoes and watch Netflix all night, you know, all the time. So we have to persevere. We have to manage our time even in our downtime, so we don't get caught up in that, you know, in that kind of dark area. And it's like this winter, like say we haven't been out snowshoeing or skiing, which is tough. But there's other ways of getting exercise, walk your dog, you know, getting out, helping, you know, maple sapping, maple syruping. A lot of people who live in the city, just get out, and there's a lot of park systems. You just get out and enjoy some of the parks in the cities just outside, you know, these, urban areas. So, I mean, let's face it, Canada is becoming almost entirely an urban population. And with a lot of new Canadians coming in who, you know, and we aren't necessarily adept at tripping in the outdoors. So there's an educational thing, that component there as well, for people who are not used to camping and, well, being in nature and being away from that comfort zone.
Those things that we are so kind of fortunate that we're almost privileged, whether you come from money or not, but you're privileged to have these things to many of us, you know, that live outside of the urban centers in our backyards, like I do here. And if you're from a country where, or just a place in Canada or a place in the States where you don't have that, you can be scared of a bunny rabbit. Like, you know, it's true. Like some, you know, and so, you know, I think it's important for there to be a system and a place for people that aren't engaging the outdoors to get into it and to at least experience and then hopefully think that, hey, this is something that is worth protecting. You know, I always hear people complaining about, you know, the population's too big and that, and there's some truth to that. But I also saw a thing where in India that has a massive population, a bunch of people rallied and they all, many hands make light work is where I'm getting with this. And they got all these thousands of people to replant an entire forest that if they didn't have that population, it would have taken longer. So in some ways I think that there's a way that maybe we can use that to our strength. You know, there's more and more people here all the time, and we don't have a choice and either way, except to try to do something as best we can with it.
Yeah. That's a double-edged sword there too, because I mean, I can't fathom thousands of people flocking into Algonquin Park, for example.
Right.
The environment can only take so much traffic.
Yeah.
So that's one thing is to manage what we have on a sustainable basis. That's, you know, that's a tricky one when you think about it.
It is. It is. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have all the answers, but I think that, you know, people getting outdoors, we all know how good that is just for their own personal mental health. I know that a lot more people, if they saw that path, they would like to do something to get into writing, would like to do something, especially a lot of people that follow and watch our content, read your books, would probably think, hey, it's pretty cool to find a way to run a lodge and to be an outfitter, to guide and all these kinds of things. So, I hope that I'm sure you have. I hope that I can help inspire some people to do that too. You know, I don't know if that's something that is important to you as well, to try to teach other people to.
That's ultimately important for my wife, Andrea, and I, Cabin Falls or whatever. I think almost whatever we do. And we get feedback. I mean, the feedback's nice. And it keeps us primed to keep doing what we're doing. And that's, like you say, it's, you know, if you inspire people in the right way, that's going to enrich their lives. And I've had several people at shows and write to me that the experiences they've had with my wife and I has changed their lives to the better. And that's shared with their family. And it all basically has to do with the outdoors. Not in a hardcore way like you and I, kind of thing, but in a soft sense. And I think, you know, the majority of people, that's the way they look at nature. You know, they're not going to be jumping their canoes off waterfalls and that kind of thing.
Right.
So, and there's a lot available out there. I know there's not enough out there, especially in Ontario. That's a whole other issue. It's the Ontario parks. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to get into that.
But we could do another podcast on that, one next
that
time.
That could be another yeah. podcast. Yeah, the environment movement, pretty interesting, though, in this part of the country. A lot of people don't realize that it was kickstarted at the same time as the Greenpeace. But they got all the fanfare, right? Mm-hmm. The Greenpeace did.
Right. Yeah, and is there anything you'd like to just direct people towards? You mentioned Earth Roots. We touched on that a little bit. Maybe your website, social media, or anything where people can learn more about some of these conservation efforts and more about your books and all that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, for sure. Earth Roots has been around for a long time. It's got some great campaigns from the Toronto, protecting the Toronto Greenbelt to the Eastern Wolf to working at Grassy Narrows and helping the Indigenous up there to Temagami, which is their hallmark key campaign. A lot of history and often doing the dirty work where a lot of the mainstream environmental organizations won't get their hands dirty with. So earthroots.org, go to the website and, there's all kinds of things going on with that organization. And as far as like Cabin Falls Eco Lodge, cabinfalls.ca, everything's on the website there, all the information. And we talk to a lot of people, walk them through how to paddle in. We're getting more and more people paddling in and out, which is great because the more we don't have to use the air service, the better. Mm-hmm. My own site, hapwilson.com, a lot on that site. It's my own online store. Stories.
You're on Instagram too.
Instagram, Hap Wilson 1951, Facebook, YouTube, Sanctuary. Go to Cabin Falls. You'll see our little few videos that we have.
I like the one where you build a catamaran with your canoes and you're just bringing in all this building material.
Yeah, that's, we've done that. We've been running catamarans down with 3/4 of a ton of lumber on. Meanwhile, there's paddlers waiting to run the rapids, not knowing if they can make it down in a single boat. so we're winding down through. We know where the channels are. We've done this for decades now. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, Hap, awesome for great to have you come out, man. Great conversation, and thanks a lot. Good having you.
Thanks, Jim, and thanks for the invitation.
You're welcome.
Keep the fire burning.
I will.